My name is Michael McCusker. Surely the Republican Party, USA, has more possible candidates for the presidency than Donald Trump. A cartoon from his initial campaign in 2015, Trump says to a veteran POW in a wheelchair, "I like people that weren't captured." The vet responds, "I like people who weren't draft dodgers." Truth and justice for Trump would be for the many women he has sexually assaulted over the decades to stone him in the old biblical manner. It should not be forgotten that the Trump family fortune was founded in late 19th century Alaska Gold Rush whorehouses, and that the current Trump patriarch has been in the same business since, minus the strumpets. The Donald, as he is sometimes known, certainly turned the White House into a political brothel when he occupied it last time, though there is evidence predecessors were not reticent to do the same. And now, as American colleges erupt in traditional vernal mayhem, I would like to refer to a statement by the Political Strike Committee at Portland State University in 1970 as a cogent universal manifesto for the current campus collisions. Why a student strike? Most people think of a strike only in economic terms, as a device by labor to gain money from management. However, in this case, the strike is political. Just as labor organizers to withhold their productive power from individual company, to force it to accede to their demands, students strike to withhold their potential productive managerial power from a system that is exploiting their minds and bodies by expecting them to support and participate in a society that perpetuates unjust, imperialistic wars, that denies full equality to its citizens, that manufactures such hideous weapons of death as nerve gas, and that intimidates and even murders those who speak out against it. The American political system tries to compromise on moral issues for which no compromise is possible. Either a system has a war or it does not. It either is racist or it is not. It either manufactures and stores lethal weapons or it does not. It either crushes dissent or it does not. There is no halfway point on any of these issues. One important part of the strike is political education of those inside and outside the university who have some reservations about the direction this country is going, but who look on American repression and armed expansion into foreign countries as mistakes of individuals, not as logical outgrowths of American ideology and an expansionist economy. The object of political education is to bring people to the realization that this system has to change, that America is not the land of the free and the brave, as high school history texts have it. The American dream of freedom and equal opportunity for each citizen to develop him or herself has not yet been realized, as many on the other side of the generation gap believe. The only American dream that has approached realization is a material one. America is merely a land of compulsive consumers who mistake the freedom to choose between 25 brands of breakfast cereal for freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is meaningless unless the choices to be made relate to the fundamental concerns and lives of the citizens. Since the American government and economy, as they are presently constituted, have no room for this kind of freedom, those who, like many white radicals and black radicals, attempt to make these kinds of decisions by building their own communities and dissenting from the middle American party line, are put down by the government for affirming that they intend to have a freedom of choice. But why strike against the university, that supposed bastion of free speech and intellectual interchange? Very simply, because this idea of the American university is a myth. Universities are complicit with the arms and perpetuation of the Vietnam War. Faculty members of Michigan State University served as ideological hacks for the DM regime and even had the ugly American gall to present the Vietnamese with a prepackaged, made in the USA business and government bureaucracies. Historically, it is worth recalling, American universities have never remained aloof from the practical concerns of the nation. Indeed, the great land-grant colleges and universities that dot the U.S. were created to serve the state in far more than education alone. Their faculties provide reference bureaus for state legislatures, and universities effort on behalf of the federal government, ranging from military training to strategic research, helped fuel the early student anti-war movement. It is crucial to note here that service to the state is in itself not bad, but support of inhuman government projects is indefensible. A university education should promote critical thought, not blind following. Universities rarely educate their students to think for themselves or to make moral decisions. They merely focus on turning out technical hacks. Universities also serve as vehicles for institutionalized racism. Black Americans are turned away from universities because the American racist system does not allow them to earn the money to pay for higher education. And that's a quote. The curriculum of most universities is patently racist. They deny the validity of the cultural identity of Black and Chicano and Oriental and Indian Americans. Because of this, many Black students, and et al., understandably find the university to be irrelevant to their lives and concerns. The Portland State University administration sees fit to initiate work on a memorial service for murdered white students, but not for murdered Black students. The university, the trainer of technocrats, might as well admit, as Vice President Agnew has, that it wants and tried to be for whites only. And that is also a quote, the for whites only part. And the whole thing is a quote from the Portland State University Strike Committee of spring 1970. And to carry that a little bit farther, I'd like to read something by Arthur Honeyman, dubiously involved in important matters. May 11th, 1970, enjoys a designation in Oregon history, Bloody Monday, which commemorates an attack by Portland police 54 years ago upon a demonstration at Portland State University in protest of the Vietnam War, in particular, the attack on Cambodia and the overthrow of its government. The demonstration was part of a nationwide university strike. There was also an angry reaction to the killings by National Guardsmen of four white students at Kent State, Ohio, and two Black students at Jackson State, Mississippi. For a number of years, wreaths of flowers were placed each May 11th, where the police attacked in the park box across from Portland State University. After a while, as the war waned and finally ended 54 years ago, Bloody Monday was generally forgotten. And this by Arthur Honeyman. Bloody Monday, May 11th, 1970, was the day after my 30th birthday. Believe it or not, this factor induced me to be absent on the day that the Portland tax squad hit. The odd thing is that though I am the type of physical coward who closes his eyes when a foam rubber ball is tossed to him. And though some of those present have repeatedly told me that I lucked out by not being there, I've always felt a sense of remorse for going home to clean and rest up. I mean, after all, what did I think it was, my birthday? I could have been a contender. My participation in the actual protest event of May 1970 was both accidental and marginal, although I definitely supported any anti-war activity. In point of fact, however, I was somewhat heavily involved in my 1970 campaign to be elected to the Oregon legislature and was focusing on the task of trying to win the upcoming May primary. It is quite possible that, had my campaign manager not shamed me into it, I would have steered clear of the whole incident. If I have calculated correctly, for my usually good memory fails me here, Tuesday, May 12, 1970, was both the day when I lost the primary and the day that just about all of Portland's liberaldom marched to City Hall and rallied in protest of Monday's brutality of the TAC police squad. As I recall, the Oregonian shot a photograph of me giving a garbled speech that nobody understood, but everybody applauded. The story of my insignificant participation in the PUSU event goes something like this. On Friday evening, May 8, 1970, I sat in a tavern drinking cheap Burgundy wine, Red Death, it's called by some heavy imbibers, such as I was at the time, celebrating our final fling at campaigning with my manager. You should go support the strike, he said. I think all I wanted to do was get drunk, but my conscience pricked me, so I belted down my beverage, purchased a bottle, and wheeled and reeled my wheelchair way down to the barricades, where I spent the next 40 hours or so thinking historical event and the like. Yes, always the self-perceived historian, even before majoring in the subject, back when Portland State University was Portland City College, and also the wannabe Norman Mailer-type journalist, I perused the scene with the astuteness of an alcohol-befuddled military strategist. Always the romantic, this was Bastille Day, almost 200 years later. Yet, at the same time, I constantly questioned my sanity for remaining after my campaign manager, who had long ago left the scene, offered to get me home. To this day, I have no idea why I chose to stay as long as I did, all night Friday, all day and all night Saturday, and most of Sunday, my birthday. You see, I march to my own drummer, and there are few things that repulse me more than the thought of being blindly swept into events like sheep milling their way over a precipice of no return. But somehow, I was analytically conscious that I had indeed committed myself to this course of action, and I both marveled and trembled at my epiphanous knowledge of the moment as I objectively surveyed the ludicrous makeshift barricades constructed, as it were, of overturned park benches, garbage cans, chains, street repair barriers, and anything else to obstruct easy access to the South Park blocks in Portland, near Portland State University. Everybody knew that the barricades were symbolic and that a fortress they did not make. Nonetheless, they did block angry pro-war supporters from mowing us down with their vehicles instead of merely throwing beer bottles at us as they drove by. I may be mistaken, but I seem to recall that one such cruiser tried to ram through a barrier of benches. I could see that my presence wasn't really needed, and that, like the barricades, it was merely useful as a symbol, only to an even lesser degree. For if and when push came to shove, this cerebral palsied individual would be in the way and would be one more thing to worry about in the face of catastrophe or emergency. Thus, I took it upon myself to stay out of the way and, paradoxically, to wander among the strikers, the troops I stupidly romanticized, to give them moral support or, in retrospect, possibly to show how brave I was. I was fully involved now, though I was also engaging myself in a mental versus emotional balancing act. To jargonize, these were suddenly my brothers and sisters, my comrades, yet I still tried to maintain perspective. In a sense, I was being hypocritical in more ways than one. First, I was betraying what little commitment I had toward historical accuracy and objectivity. Second, I was espousing the concept of human brotherhood and solidarity, even though I feared that too much of it might lead to fascism, as it did in Europe in the 1930s. Third, I believed in the anti-war movement, but it was not number one on my list of priorities, as I was pretending. And fourth, I was acting as though I were a college student when I had graduated 5 years before. In the final analysis, however, I told myself, as I generally do when I pursue a course of action in behalf of a cause, that action is better than inaction, no matter how futile a situation appears. One of the things I remember myself declaring whenever I was asked if I really thought protesting war would bring it to a halt went something like, well, no, but if we don't protest it, sure as hell it won't stop. Or I would cynically sidestep the issue by snidely saying, peace is not peace unless it's forever, and we're not going to live that long. Needless to say, these unnecessary and laconic remarks were received in a variety of ways, as I expected, but I was sincere in my newfound belief in the value of what we were trying to achieve, nebulous though that was. So much so that the protesters became we instead of they. For once, I had joined a cause instead of creating one. In all honesty, I cannot recall getting any sleep during the 1 3/4 days in which I stayed at the scene. If I did, it was while sitting up in my walker cart, much like soldiers on horseback have done for thousands of years. What I do remember is wandering from enclave to enclave of vigilant guardians of the territory. These young protesters, some 10 years my junior, who took it upon themselves to do the dirty work outside in less than pleasant weather, while the strategists spent their nights inside the student union, openly praised me for staying with them and showed their appreciation by feeding this CP, who cannot feed himself, pouring wine from the bottle into my mouth, wino that I was, and by offering me other types of drugs that did not appeal to this Dylan Thomas-type alcohol-soaked poet. Were it not for them and the comradeship of Michael McCusker, with whom I sealed a friendship that I believe will last the rest of my life, I question that I would have been able to hold up as long as I did. At any rate, my contribution to that incident was marginal, but its contribution to me was and is monumental. And that was by Arthur Honeyman, poet, radical, and bon vivant, who lived in Portland, where he wrote books and played on the internet and ran once for mayor. And yes, he remained my closest friend until his death in 2008, the same year my mother died. And now, in context with the previous statement by Arthur Honeyman, Spastic Power, also by Arthur Honeyman. In 1970, I was sort of an instructor at Portland State University. In the summer of 1969, I persuaded Earl McCannell of the Sociology Department to sponsor and hire me to assist him in conducting an experimental class in the fall. With his help, I created and designed a seminar-style class to promote awareness and to open communication about the hitherto taboo subject of the handicapped in society. It may be that I am mistaken, but because I was unable to locate any prototype class for the disabled, I have always believed that this was the first of its kind. Although, for example, there were the beginnings of radical disabled movements supported by lobbyists to legislate important equal rights and barrier-free laws into effect, very little was being done to establish an avenue to change attitudes about the disabled, even among radicals. The best publicity going was the Jerry Lewis Telethon, which thrived on placing the emphasis on research to cure the disability, a commendable cause which I now applaud if it doesn't conjure up the image of being helpless or pathetic, rather than also accepting handicapped individuals as potentially contributing members of society. Admittedly, I'm no scholar, but as far as I could discern, the New Testament was the only political tract that ever spoke to the issue of being handicapped in a kindly manner, and even that was demeaning in its charity. The problem of creating attitudinal change through open dialogue is very complex and difficult. The problem became most pronounced in my mind in 1970. It was then that I committed myself to being publicly visible as much as possible, and the strike strengthened my resolve. Although the historian in me recognizes that political and philosophical beliefs cannot be accurately labeled or pinpointed, fortunately, I might add, I consider myself far more radical than I was in 1970. Back then, my agenda was social upheaval at any cost. Today, my personal, political, and philosophical agenda is strictly pacifistic. Although I'm not a communist, after much consideration, I've come to the conclusion that the political disintegration of the Soviet Union is probably the second greatest tragedy to befall life as we know it since the inception of Western civilization, the first being the development of Western civilization itself. Yes, I am fully aware that I, and almost all other disabled individuals, could not survive longer than a few days without the evolution of technology advanced by Western civilization, much less thrive. And believe me, I am personally eternally grateful for being born into this society in this era. But though I believe that the disintegration marks the end of the most altruistic political entity in history, this is not why I am a radical. Political persons are not so altruistic as individuals who are dedicated to altruism. To make a long, complex story short, genuine radicals are altruists who are willingly involved in the act of placing the welfare of others above the welfare of themselves. Thus, since the phenomenon known as life is valued as the ultimate possession, a true radical would die rather than use violence to achieve goals. Although only a handful of such altruists have achieved such revolutionary success, i.e., Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., it only takes one to prove that it's not beyond the realm of feasibility, just as it took only the formation of a single vestige of existence to transform nothing into everything, declares my atheistic view of the cosmic process. Thus, as a Gandhian, I assert that armed takeover and resistance is not radical. And as an atheist, I divorce myself from faith in divine providence. Thus, I am bearing the responsibility of my own insignificant role in the cosmic process. Whether or not I live up to my standards of radicalism is another story. And that was Spastic Power by Arthur Honeyman, who died in the year 2008. And this is Michael McCusker. Happy May 11th, Discovery Day.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.